You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
You know, rough grouse, this is one of the hardiest birds in the woods, right? Mm. But they are listed as a species of conservation concern across 19 states. And in fact, grouse are now on the endangered species list in Indiana. And with American woodcock, they are listed as a species of greatest conservation concern in 29 states. So we really have our options set out in front of us. There's a big need for, like I said, the diverse forests that we're pushing for. We will lose these species if we don't take action and make sure that they have the habitat that they need.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian, and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocchi Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. In case I don't mention it enough or make it obvious, I am incredibly grateful to have the opportunity to do this podcast, share it, and connect with so many amazing people. And my guest today is another one that validates this. Ashley Peters is the Director of Communications and Marketing for the Rough Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society. She's a conservationist, newer hunter, and carries some deep envy for anyone that owns a bird dog. But, as you'll soon hear, her preferred bird dog breed makes her even more cool in my book. As most of you know, I'm a big advocate for people supporting the organizations of the birds you chase after. So if you're hunting rough grouse or American woodcock, join this organization that's going above and beyond to help these forests and the birds to provide that opportunity for you. They have an awesome membership drive going on right now that you'll hear about in this episode. And since this is airing near the end of the drive, Ashley said that they would honor this promo if you mention you heard it on the Bird Dog Babe podcast. So let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition. And that's why I trust and feed Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, ProPlan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized dog food formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. Purina supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina ProPlan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28-gauge, and 410, direct-to-consumer pricing and cases ship right to your door. Shoot Boss, pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots, reduce crippling, and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and the partners that are helping me to keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on patreon.com/thebirddogbabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation, and another 5% goes to conservation. Dakota 283 unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed panel latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. Newer seasoned hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. And while you're there, say hello to Julia, Siren's new 12-gauge sporting that is one of the most stunning shotguns I've laid my eyes on. Also buy Big Frig roto-molded coolers with heavy-duty latches, dual stainless steel lock plates that double as bottle openers. They also have dry boxes, tumblers, and growlers, and my favorite, the ability to customize the tumblers and coolers. Head to thebirddogbabe.com/bigfrig to view the wide array of sizes and colors available. There's a Badlands cooler perfect for your way of life. Good morning, Ashley. Welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Courtney. How are you?
I'm very good. I like doing these morning episodes because I just feel like I'm all ready to go. It's not the end of the day when stressors have hit. So I appreciate you joining me this morning. They're my favorite.
Yeah, of course. This is great.
Yes. So where are you coming to us from today?
Sure. I am based out of Maple Grove, Minnesota, which is in the northwest corner of the Twin Cities, just outside of Minneapolis.
Awesome. I know that area well. Minnesota's a good place. And have you always lived in Minnesota?
No, I've lived a few places. I grew up in Iowa, small town, Eldora, about 3,000 people, farming community. So that's where I spent the first 18 years of my life. And then 4 years in Missouri, a year up in Alaska, 4 years in Minnesota, back up to Alaska, down to Louisiana.
Wow.
And then back to Minnesota about 5.5 years ago.
So you really like that cold Minnesota winter then, huh? Keep going back there.
Well, you can't argue with how many outdoor opportunities, this region has. And so sure. I keep coming back to Minnesota in part because the community, the outdoors community here is just incredible. And in terms of accessible opportunities, I love it. It's always been one of my favorites, but especially in adulthood, having that access to a more urban center where you can connect with people, but then also within, 2 or 3 hours, having really great access to high quality habitat. Mm. And Minnesota is really unique in that we have 4 different biomes in the state, which means, our prairie and our forests are right next to each other. And so it's really cool to be able to go up and grouse hunt one day, and then you can go over and pheasant hunt in another day.
How far do you have to go for rough grouse there?
Not as far as you would think, but I'd say good grouse hunting from the Twin Cities is a 2 or 3 hour drive.
Okay. Nice. Yeah, that's really good. And pheasant, is that about the same?
Yeah.
Different direction?
Yep. You can find grouse and pheasant within an hour of the Twin Cities, but those are usually pretty high pressure areas. So the birds are usually a little smarter. I'd say 2 or 3 hours drive, either west or north. You can get to some really great stuff. And then 2 or 3 hour drive down to southeast Minnesota for some fly fishing.
Nice. So tell us a little bit about your path to where you are right now. So why you're in Minnesota and a little bit about going around the different states.
Sure. Yeah. So growing up in Iowa, I always thought I wanted to be a writer, but spent a ton of time outdoors. And so a lot of the journals, I wrote in my journal regularly as a kid. And so in my journals, I talk a lot about being outdoors and how much I love the woods and watching wildlife, right? And when I got to college, I got a degree in communications, but didn't really know what I wanted my focus to be. And to be honest, in college, I didn't really know that you could have a career in conservation. It seemed like something that was out of reach for someone who grew up as, you know, a machinist's daughter. We didn't really have a lot of spare income. And so I needed to make sure I could pay my student loans with my career. And after college, went up to Alaska and then came to Minnesota into the Boundary Waters and did field work. So I was working with a lot of different land management agencies doing trail work or forest thinning or really whatever project they had. So for a couple of years, I just lived in the woods, lived on site, camped out of a tent, and did a lot of work with different land management agencies. And that really informed my perspective and opinions on a lot of conservation. You know, I had this mindset when I started out that going up to Alaska, I was going to be planting trees and beautifying parks and that sort of thing. And I got up there and they handed me a chainsaw and they were like, okay, we need you to do a lot of forest maintenance. And so that really helped me understand kind of the wide range of different needs within different ecosystems. So I ended up back in Minnesota several years ago. In part, I was working for the National Audubon Society, and a position opened up here. So I moved back to take it. And I just really love this area. It's like I said, so full of a great community and great resources nearby.
Mm-hmm. So with the Audubon, what was it? The National Audubon Society?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So how long were you there?
I was there for 7 years. I started for 2 years in Louisiana and then moved up here. And then last fall, I started with the Ruffed Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society.
Okay. So are you a bird watcher as well then?
I am. Yes.
Awesome.
You're outing me.
No, I love it. I love it. I overdosed on ornithology in college. So, tell me what your favorite warbler is.
And it just doesn't get much better than the Blackburnian warbler. I feel like they're the jack-o'-lantern of songbirds.
Yes.
You know, like such bright orange colors. So I love Blackburnian warblers when I can find one. But, you know, black and white warblers, how cool of a, like, it looks like it should be a cartoon.
Have you ever banded warblers?
So I haven't myself, but I've been to a lot of banding events, taken a lot of photos of that sort of thing. My favorite thing watching kids band birds is always when like they'll look up and they'll be like, I can feel its heart beating, you know, like I just think that's so sweet.
It is so cool.
So I love going to those. Have you done bandings before?
I have with warblers. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. In Northern Wisconsin, yeah, they're just the most little, delicate, cool birds.
So cool.
Yeah, they're neat and just. I'm obsessed with them. I haven't seen them as much here out in Montana, so I kind of miss that. But I know they're around, so I just need to be more active in finding them.
Yeah, they definitely take some work finding where they are. And even once you figure out where they are, it's identifying them. And, you know, when I worked at Audubon, people talked a lot about getting warbler neck in the springs. And it always had to do with, you know, the extended amount of time that you're staring straight up into the treetops.
I like that. Warbler neck. You know, I was actually surprised at how many cedar waxwings we have here.
Oh yeah, that's such a great
they're so cool.
I always think they look like they're made out of frosting or something.
Right. Yes, they're very cool. Okay, sorry. I told you I sometimes go down rabbit holes.
That's great. It's all birds, right?
So. It is. So tell me kind of about how you got into hunting. Is that in Iowa, you're surrounded by lots of pheasant hunting there. Is that where you started growing up or was it later on?
You would think so, right? Like there's really great deer hunting and pheasant hunting and all sorts of stuff in Iowa. But no, I actually, I grew up as mostly a sports kid. So running cross country and track and in the summers, you know, working the field. So detasseling corn. I don't know if you know what that is.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in Wisconsin picking rocks and detasseling corn. You bet. It's a good way to get through school money.
Yeah, exactly. So that was what I did mostly growing up. And I'll be honest that, you know, in our community, at least, hunting was very much framed as a thing the guys did. And so it wasn't often talked about as something that women got into and were passionate about. And so I just don't think it ever crossed my mind that I could be a hunter because it was so male dominated, at least in my community where I grew up. And so when I moved back to Minnesota several years ago, I'd been thinking about hunting a lot because I really like, you know, I really like the idea of just being out in the woods and, you know, looking for game. But it also, it really brings you into the mindset of whatever you're hunting. And I feel like when I start hunting a new species, it really just, it makes me think a lot harder about what that species needs in terms of habitat and food and cover. And you get to know something so much more intimately. And I knew that from reading a lot of, you know, different nature magazines, different outdoors magazines. So when I moved back to Minnesota, I was really excited that there was a strong recruitment, retention, and reactivation community here within the hunting space. And so I was fortunate to have a lot of access to folks who were really open to inviting me along, different events that gave you a taste of things without being too intimidating, folks that were just like, come along, you don't have to shoot, you can just join us to kind of see what it's like. So really welcoming community was critical to me getting into hunting.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a specific mentor or was it more the groups that you mentioned?
I would say it's everyone. It's almost, I think it's almost too much to expect one person, right, to guide somebody through every step. It's really helpful to have a lot of different perspectives. So it was a group of people, but to your point, there is usually kind of one person that you go back to consistently to get advice from or to get, you know, you really trust their perspective. So Julia Schrenkler, who actually sits on the Minnesota DNR's R3 Council, she has really been a consistent mentor for me. And always makes hunting really fun, which is something I don't think I really understood before I started hunting, is that, you know, despite photos and videos of kind of a very stoic looking community, the hunting community is full of just amazing, funny, outgoing, kind people. And Julia has really embodied that for me and helped me to understand that's a goal, right? Mm-hmm. As a hunter is to not only be a good conservationist, but to be really welcoming to folks and help them understand who we are as hunters.
In Minnesota, I feel like in that area, there's a lot of like becoming an outdoors woman. I know Pheasants Forever has a all women's chapter there that's really active. Are you involved in any of those or have you gone to any of their events?
So I've done more of like the presentations and Modern Carnivore is an organization that's here in the Twin Cities and they do a lot of outreach. And I have been to past Becoming an Outdoors Woman programs. Mm-hmm. I've also participated in events held by the Women's Hunting and Fishing Group.
Okay.
So yeah, I've certainly taken part in those, and it really is the whole community coming together, right? It takes a lot of different events and outreach pieces to get people engaged. So I feel, like I said, I can't say it enough, that I feel really fortunate to be in Minnesota and to be surrounded by people who see the invitation to new hunters as part of pretty much every event.
What was that point when you decided to start carrying a gun and hunting yourself rather than walking with and watching what was going on? What made you make that transition?
Yeah. So I think one thing from my perspective as someone who learned to hunt as an adult is that I was really encouraged ahead of time to go trap shooting and to get really comfortable with shooting a gun before I was in the field. And I'll say that I think that that was the biggest hurdle, was having never really owned a gun before or, you know, had to maintain a gun. And so learning that over the summer before we went out hunting, and then when we did go out hunting, I did always carry a gun, but it was helpful to have somebody say, like, you don't have to shoot. So then I never, you know, felt pressure to shoot when I was uncomfortable or didn't, you know, wasn't sure if it was safe. And so it was really that we had a group of ladies who got together that summer every couple of weeks and went trap shooting. And it made me so much more comfortable when I got into the field and I was navigating, you know, holes in the field and trees and all these other hurdles, right? And so by then I was comfortable enough with the gun that it wasn't keeping me from enjoying the experience. It was a challenge, but it wasn't overwhelming.
What a fun time, a bunch of women getting together. And would you guys like do a league, or did you just have like fun night?
It was just fun night. It was just us getting together because several of us were kind of learning together. So Julia, my mentor, had just learned to hunt 4 years before I did. And then a couple of the other ladies also were just learning to hunt. So we were all kind of learning together and sharing tips with each other. And so we just get together, go shoot a couple rounds of trap, talk about anything that we didn't, you know, understand, or things we'd found. And then, yeah, went out for a beer and dinner afterwards and
that sounds amazing.
Hung out. And it was such a great community building experience,
right?
And getting to know the gun. And that really set me up, I think, for success that first hunting season.
Right. Right. Did you guys ever have instructors there, like helping you, giving you tips, or did you just all kind of help each other out in that aspect?
A little bit of both. Yeah,
okay.
We did have some of the instructors at the gun ranges come out and help us a couple of times. And then often, you know, it's like making sure that you know enough to be safe and then messing up. messing up until you get it right. And
right.
And that's really what that summer, that first summer was about. And if I'm being honest, still summers are about that. Like when I go trap shooting, I feel like I have to relearn some things after being out of practice all winter.
What have you all hunted?
So I've hunted ruffed grouse, obviously, American woodcock, ducks, and pheasant. And then I haven't hunted deer, but I have processed several deer, and I
okay.
really enjoy that. So, not much beyond the birds.
What's your favorite bird to hunt?
Obviously the ruffed grouse.
Is it?
No, I really enjoy ruffed grouse because the woods have always been kind of home for me, despite growing up in farm country. You know, being in the woods always felt so different. And so with ruffed grouse, it's so great to get into the woods, especially I think my favorite time of year is right in the fall when all the leaves are down and that first hard frost comes in and kind of creates a crust. I just love the sound of walking through the woods and your feet kind of busting through that crust on the leaves.
And then hearing that that flush fly up from there.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah. Good.
It's a lot of good sounds, isn't it?
Absolutely.
What would you say is your bucket list hunt? What would you really like to do? Or even do you have plans this year to hunt something different?
Sure. So I'm part-time in grad school right now, so that's taken up a lot of my springs. But I think next year I would really like to get out turkey hunting.
Okay.
Seems like a pretty accessible thing to do. But kind of bucket lists, like I have to save up some money to do it. I would say going to hunt ptarmigan in Alaska would be mm-hmm. amazing.
Right. Did you come across ptarmigan at all while you were up there?
Not that I remember, but I spent most of my time in Juneau, so a little farther away from most of the ptarmigan habitat. Mm-hmm.
So we have to get into the bird dog talk.
Yes.
So, and I know, you know, you probably have some good strategies with this too, because you aren't currently hunting with a dog. Are you usually solo, or do you go out with somebody that does have dogs?
I'm almost always with other folks who have dogs. I'm really fortunate to have a lot of friends who are more than happy to have me come along. And I've actually found that it really opens me up to being able to hunt with new people a lot. Just because, you know, there's not as many questions around, will the dogs get along? How do they hunt together? Mm-hmm. There's some logistics, right, around hunting two dogs or three dogs together for the first time. And so I've just been really fortunate to have folks invite me along and say, like, come on out and enjoy hunting next to my dog. And man, it's so great to get to see all the different breeds of dogs hunting, like such differences in personality. That has been so much fun for me over the past few years to really experience is all the different personalities that it goes along with the different breeds.
Sure. Are you mainly hunting with pointers or flushers?
A little bit of both, but okay. I'd say I've probably hunted more over pointers, GSPs, Gordon setters, those are probably English setters, you know, those are probably most. But my friend Emmy has a flat-coated retriever.
Cool.
And he is just super fun in the field. And I don't know if I'm sure a lot of folks know what a flat-coated retriever looks like, but I love being in the field with her dog because he looks like a black-haired version of the dog world's Fabio, if that makes sense. Like, like the hair is so flowy
and shiny.
It's really fun.
Yeah, they're a beautiful breed for sure.
Yes, they're gorgeous.
So if you were to get a bird dog, have you decided which breed you're leaning towards?
Oh man, this is always tricky, right? Because as soon as I say, I get emails suggesting otherwise.
Do you?
Like I'm really tempted to just keep it close and not say, but I won't lie that I really lean towards a GWP right now, based on my lifestyle and what I need and what I've seen of those dogs. But I'm always open to suggestions. So
yeah, I'm totally not going to talk you out of that because they're a fantastic breed.
Yes,
they absolutely are. The goal, the only thing is you have to be smarter than the dog. And I think you'll have that nailed.
We'll see.
It's structure.
Yeah, which is like why I said, you know, being in grad school, it takes up so much time. And really everything that I've learned from folks about owning a bird dog is everything in the beginning is about how much time you get to spend with that dog, whether mm-hmm. it's training, whether it's in the field. It's just all about making sure that you're consistent and that you spend a ton of time reinforcing that consistency.
Yes, exactly. And I think, I don't know, I do well on structure myself. So I think it just flows easily from with the dogs and how we work our every days. So, yeah, but no, I'm totally going to support that decision and and ignore the hate mail.
Yeah. I said, I hesitate because I know people feel very strongly about the dogs that they have in their lives, but for good reason, right? Like everybody has different needs. And I think that's the wonderful thing about dogs is that you have so many different choices depending on what your lifestyle is and what you're hunting and what you need, even in terms of family. You know, Courtney, your podcast has covered that quite a bit, you know, trying to make sure that hunting is like fitting into your lifestyle and that the dogs you have fit into that too. Right. And I really love that message.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks. And that's just it. And, you know, I it's a sad thing when people, I've heard the phrase of we have kids and so we can't do the things that we used to do anymore. And that's not true. That's not true. You just got to pivot, right? Isn't that the COVID word of the year? Make a pivot. So make that pivot. Yes, you can do it.
I think that's true.
So let's talk about your role at RGS.
Sure.
So what do you do there?
I'm the marketing and communications director. I took that position last fall. So actually next week will be my 6-month mark at the organization.
Very cool. And what a amazing time to get into that position. And flexibility in making that pivot, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, as hard as the last year has been, because it really, you know, it's been really tough for almost every nonprofit I'm aware of. The great thing is that it does reframe things and help folks to think differently about how we can reach out to people and how we can communicate our mission and connect with folks. So, you know, RGS traditionally had been very focused on banquets and events, and that will always be a big part of what we do. But now, like you said, pivoting and figuring out, you know, what are other ways that we can talk to folks about our mission delivery and what we're doing, get them involved, educate them, all of that. So there's a lot of tools and resources through online communications that help us reach audiences that we may have not reached traditionally.
Right. And I'm sure that's, especially in your position, that's where you've probably been hitting it extra hard in these last few months because of what's been going on, because you're working on that outreach through different methods than having those in-person events. So what is that going to look like moving forward? Are you guys starting to open up and plan events again?
We have a few events. I mean, it's very cautious at this time, right? We want to make sure that folks are safe, and that we're following state protocol. But with things warming up a little bit, I think it's easier to host those outdoor events where, as long as you follow some guidelines, and stay outdoors, it's usually, pretty safe. And so, we will be having some events at the beginning of summer, but moving into the fall, I think it's a lot about how much the vaccine distribution is happening and just kind of gauging things as they go.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's all we can really do right now. Take it one step at a time. For those that don't know, can you give us a description on what is Ruffed Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society, and what exactly do they do?
Sure. Yeah. So the Ruffed Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society are two organizations that have really come together for one forest-focused mission. And the RGS, so the Ruffed Grouse Society, is a 60-year-old organization that brings conservationists together to improve wildlife habitat and forest health. You know, and what we do benefits humans too, local economies, you know, the wellness that stems from having public land benefits. And so a lot of our work is on the ground. We do forest conservation projects. Our chapters will do local projects to improve habitat around them for ruffed grouse, American woodcock, songbirds. We also do a lot of advocacy. So making sure that, you know, the on the ground work is the most important thing, but a lot of times you have to advocate for certain policies or funding or regulations that ensure that habitat creation. And so we do a lot of policy advocacy as well. And obviously outreach. So we are always talking to our members and those around us about the importance of conservation.
And I think a lot of times, you know, we look at these, the conservation groups, and we don't necessarily know what's all going on. You know, we're renewing our membership every year and knowing our money's going towards habitat and conservation, but what exactly is always a little bit in the unknown, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So I like that you went into that where it's kind of like, we do a lot of boots on the ground, and the advocacy for the different policies that are trying to be put in place that aren't the best decision moving forward, that's become a really big thing. I mean, it's become really big in even dog events as well. That's what I'm more aware of. And
sure.
But can you go into that a little bit, like some of the struggles that we're having with public lands and some of the policies trying to be put in place that we need to be aware of, and helping organizations like RGS to, I don't know, fight against those?
Sure. Yeah. There's kind of the bigger broad brush, right, is we need those public lands. And that's really critical for many reasons. One of which, right, is like those public lands are so important for management. There are plenty of opportunities to work with private landowners, but with public lands, we have so much more opportunity to weigh into those things, to look at the overall management plans, to have a voice in trying to push agencies and organizations to ensure wildlife habitat creation, you know, and the contiguous nature of a lot of those pieces of property. Whereas with private landowners, it takes a very concerted, it takes a lot of big efforts to get everybody on the same page and pulling in the same direction. So both of those things are things we need, but the public mm-hmm. lands are certainly critical for the work that we do and the habitat that wildlife needs. The other thing that, you know, I'll point to that, you know, I think things are a little bit different out west, but certainly in the eastern U.S., there's a real need for younger forest. So really leading into some forest management things and needing to have forests that are really balanced, right? You need those older woods, you need those middle-aged woods, but we also need those younger forests to hold habitat for ruffed grouse, American woodcock, and warblers, like what we were mm-hmm. talking about earlier. And in northern Minnesota, I've been really encouraged to see just so much habitat creation. There's incredible habitat up there that also houses, you know, birds like golden-winged warbler. And so really trying to get policies in place that allow a really balanced approach to having diverse forests. At least that's one of the key focuses for RGS and AWS.
What is the current state right now of ruffed grouse and woodcock? Are they hurting yeah. compared to what they were 10 years ago?
It's not been great. You know, ruffed grouse, this is one of the hardiest birds in the woods, right? Mm-hmm. But they are listed as a species of conservation concern across 19 states.
Wow.
And in fact, grouse are now on the endangered species list in Indiana. And with American woodcock, they are listed as a species of greatest conservation concern in 29 states. So we really have our mission set out in front of us. There's a big need for like I said, the diverse forests that we're pushing for, because we will lose these species if we don't take action and make sure that they have the habitat that they need.
Those statistics, I had no idea it was that state. And
yeah,
this is because
stark.
That's the results of lack of good habitat.
Correct. I mean, there are always other factors that come into play, right? Development, disease, you know, those sorts of things. But, you know, even with West Nile virus, what scientists have found is that if you have high quality habitat available, those birds are more likely to survive a bout of West Nile virus versus if a bird is already struggling, right? And they don't have a lot of great habitat. Mm-hmm. If they get West Nile virus, there's perhaps a higher rate of that bird not making it, you know? And so, high quality habitat is really at the top of the list for all sorts of reasons.
With the West Nile virus, is that something that's an issue throughout the U.S. in the entire species, or is that allocated to a certain area?
It's pretty widespread. And, you know, it affects more than just ruffed grouse. There are a number of different species that scientists have found that virus in. And I think, you know, we're still learning. One of the great programs that is, you know, across a few different states is hunters submitting the wings of ruffed grouse that they harvest so that scientists can test that and get a better understanding of where all this disease is and, you know, how it is affecting populations.
That's really good to know. Do you know what that, the website is for that offhand, or else I can throw it in our show notes as well?
It's different for each state, but if you just go to roughgrousesociety.org, you can find information on West Nile virus and, you know, each different state. If you go to like the state agency website and type in West Nile virus, very likely what will pop up is information for hunters on how to submit bird wings to support that effort.
Okay. How often, I mean, should we be doing that with every bird, or do you know what the suggestion is for that?
Like I said, it kind of depends on state by state and the funding that they have available to do those studies. And so it's basically at the beginning of each season in the fall, I would just check with your state agency and see if there's funding available to submit those wings. And then usually they'll send you like an envelope that you just package your wing in and send it off to them.
Okay. Can you share something that RGS has done, like, you know, something that you guys have really pushed for and that you've seen go through?
Sure. Yeah. So my favorite thing since coming on to RGS and learning just how much is going on across all these different states. One of my favorite things that I've seen is just the policy action. So what I was saying before, you know, about making sure that we've got laws in place and regulations in place that support our lifestyle and our wildlife. And so, you know, a lot of different organizations last year pulled together for the Great American Outdoors Act. I'm sure people are probably sick of hearing about it by now because it has been so celebrated, but it's for a reason. It's because it was such a big deal. It took so many different organizations pulling on this, and RGS was right there as part of that. You know, having members weigh in, having our staff, you know, participate and make sure that the representation of RGS members was part of that conversation. So the Great American Outdoors Act I cannot say enough good things about getting that through and everybody who is a part of that. A couple other policies that we've been looking at are Restoring America's Wildlife Act was a big one last year. That's changed a little bit, but the idea behind it is really that a lot of state agencies are struggling with state level wildlife management funding. There's certain amount of federal funding that's available and that can be matched. But usually you have to have that state level wildlife funding available so that you can match it to a lot of the federal programs that exist. So policies like Restoring America's Wildlife Act and other policies that push for that more local funding is really important to being able to take full advantage of what's available to the states for wildlife management.
Okay.
And we've been involved in that. But at the moment, you know, I would say the Replant Act is something that we're working on, and that is it really helps national forests recover from wildfires. So that act allows more funding to flow to forests that need reforestation and need to recover after, you know, after a big wildfire. So we work on a wide range of different policies, but those are some of the more national, like kind of high level things that I've been really excited to be a part of since coming on to RGS.
Yeah. The Replant Act. Okay. I haven't heard of that one. So I'm
Look at it. Okay. I was really interested to learn more about it. Like I said, once I came on board and heard Brent Rudolph is our policy lead, and he's really an expert on that. And so if anyone has questions or wants to reach out and know more about how they can get involved, the Replant Act that's happening right now. And so we need folks to weigh in on that.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask, with your experience with forest management, what is your thought on all these wildfires that we've been having out west so much, so often? You know, I've heard the thought that it's because that there's such lack of forest management that it's happening. Can you touch on much of that, on what you know?
I will talk about it a little bit. I do want to provide the caveat that I'm not a forester.
Sure.
So yeah. I, you know, we've got foresters on staff who really could give you a much more in-depth analysis, right,
sure,
of what's going on. Mm-hmm. But that is my understanding as well, that it has a lot to do with forests that need more management. And, you know, with wildfires, those have always happened. But then when you put people right next to these forests, and in some cases you suppress those forest fires, and you don't allow timber management, there's not the regeneration of forests. There's not kind of the rotating growth of trees, right? Like you can have everything in a forest. You can have the older growth trees, middle age, young forests, but when forests are attacked by disease or they get past their, you know, prime age in terms of the age of the tree structures, you really run into issues. So yeah, that is my understanding. But like I said, I rely very heavily on our experts on staff to advise on these sorts of things, because it is really complicated. And depending on where you are, it can be different than another area.
Mm-hmm. And I'll have to get in touch with you and get maybe a recommendation of somebody to have on and talk about that, because it is important in the aspect of the whole picture and what we need to know, and even the little bits that we could do to help.
Right.
What is kind of the breakdown of membership is RGS the majority of people? Are they hunters? Are they bird fanciers? Do you kind of have a breakdown of that?
Yeah. So our most recent survey indicated that approximately 85% or more are folks who have hunted grouse within the past year. So, you know, not just hunters, not just grouse hunters, but very active grouse hunters, which is a great indication, right? That when you're out hunting and you're part of that, you want to be active on making sure that there is habitat and opportunities to hunt. So yeah, a high percentage of our members are hunters.
Okay. And how many, do you have a percentage of how many people actually hunt that are members?
It's up near 95-96%. So it's a very small sliver of our membership that don't hunt right now. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest that one of my goals is, in addition to kind of keeping our traditional membership and those who do hunt, the hope is to expand this a little bit to forest conservationists in general, right? And mm-hmm. trying to ensure that, you know, hunters and our perspective is also a message that's resonating with a broader audience, so that a lot of folks understand that the mission we have doesn't just benefit hunters. It certainly is a benefit to be able to go out in the woods and find grouse and woodcock. But the work that we're doing really does benefit a wide range of different wildlife. It benefits people. And so the goal is, you know, to diversify that a little bit and really invite new people into the conversation.
And do you know, like, an approximate how many rough grouse hunters, American woodcock hunters there are in the U.S.?
Oh, boy. I should have known you were going to ask that. You know, I don't want to quote something off the top
okay.
of my head.
Sure.
But, you know, I think the folks that we have on board are a small percentage of the overall mm-hmm. grouse hunters. And so a message I would say is, if you have ever hunted grouse, if you enjoy hunting in the woods, join RGS, because we would love to have more folks be part of the conversation and part of the community, and everybody pulling in the same direction, right?
Yes. And on that note, how do we become members?
Yes. So you can go to uplandstore.org. That's the kind of the direct to the membership page. Or you could go to roughgrousesociety.org. Either way, there's a join now button that you can click. And we actually have a really great membership offer going on right now. So our partners at Pike Gear are supporting us with this. And when you join at a $60 annual membership level, you get a $20 Pike Gear gift coupon. And with the $250 level, you can get a $75 Pike Gear gift coupon. And that's in addition, of course, to some other great pieces like our magazine, Covers Magazine, that comes out quarterly. You're joining this network. And one of the features that I really enjoy is our members only Facebook page, where you can go to see photos posted pretty regularly by folks like Tim Flanagan and Jim McCann. Jim's out of Alaska and always just has incredible photography. And so, yeah, tons of great benefits mm-hmm. to joining.
Well, neat. I didn't know about the Facebook page. I've been a member and I need to go search for that then. What is it called?
It's just Rough Grouse Society. So if you just search okay. for us, it is the members only page. So you do mm-hmm. have to get approved to get in.
Okay.
I go in and look and make sure that folks have a current membership. So if someone tries to join and their membership isn't current, they might get a note from me.
Perfect.
That, you know, it's specific, but I think that, mm-hmm. you know, for me at least, it provides an understanding, right, of like, this person is also an RGS member. They care about this issue. With some of those public Facebook pages, you're not always sure mm-hmm. who you're interacting with. So
right.
It's nice to have that community.
It is. That's a great community to be a part of. And, you know, I'm a big advocate for whatever it is you're chasing after to support that organization. And I think there's more that we can do beyond being a membership. And what are some of the things that we can do to help? I mean, beyond the membership. So make sure you become a member first. I mean, heck, I spent just a couple days chasing Chucker, and I just joined Chucker Chaser Foundation.
Nice.
I got to support them if I'm going to be out there doing it. So
that's
great. But yeah, what can we do? What can we do to help?
Well, there's a lot of things, right? So it depends on each person. But what I will say is that for us, at least right now, we're really pushing people to talk about diverse forests. you know, there was a period of time in U.S. history when forests were over harvested, over logged, but we're kind of past that period in terms of a lot of our forests. And so there is a need for sustainable, responsible timber management that does help to get some of this habitat on the ground for birds that need more diverse forests. So that's one thing. Dig into that topic, you know, start learning about diverse forests, come to us and ask questions, join our webinars, you know, and people can do that even if they're not members. We welcome everybody becoming more educated on forest related management topics. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But the other thing I would say is just as a hunter and a conservationist, I have seen a lot of councils and committees, you know, full of folks who love wildlife and conservation. And in some cases, some of the age range of folks on those committees and councils is getting older and older. And so especially for younger folks or mid-career folks, look and see what local councils and committees exist that influence the regulations and policies on wildlife management and just anything really related to a hunting lifestyle, and see if there's an opportunity for you to get involved in that way. It's always great to organize people, but when you can have a direct influence on policy like that, I think it's really rewarding. I sit on a council, a statewide council here in Minnesota, and it is a lot of work, but it's really rewarding to see the way that the work plays out.
Mm-hmm. And you guys have regional contacts as well. So if there's a way to find out if there's regional projects going on, we can find that on your website. Is that the best place?
Thank you. Yeah. So you can go to the website to find out. And like you said, there are specific regional developers, regional directors of development. Their titles recently changed. So you can reach out to those folks and find out what's going on. They'll direct you to a local chapter if you'd like to get engaged at a chapter level. Or like you said, they can just reach out and find out what's happening and what they could get involved with.
Okay. What about out here in the West? So when I was looking, we don't have somebody for Montana, Idaho. We have rough grouse here.
Yes, you do. And if folks would like to start chapters, I'm more than happy to help guide them on how to do that. So a lot of our efforts are based on, you know, where our chapter membership is really based. And so we do have a few folks out west and really appreciate whenever we hear about them. We've actually got some stories coming up in future magazines more about some western states. So we mm-hmm. we do appreciate the grouse out there. And cool. I'm looking forward to getting out west at some point.
They're so different
out there. Yeah,
so I've heard. yeah, they're different. Not all rough grouse are created equal.
What has your experience been that's been a little bit different out west?
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know. Like, we did an episode on this. I'm just like, oh my gosh, I don't want you to talk about it. Okay. So I'm sure what any animal would be like that is completely unpressured, right?
Sure.
So that's, and that's, I think, the best way to say it. I hunted northern Wisconsin woods for 8 years, and they're just a different animal compared to what's here. You know, you would hear the flush, and then you'd like, they would just disappear in the distance, and you would go like, you know, you could kind of see them gliding down, and you're like, did I hit that? Or is it just continuing to fly? I can't really tell. It just, you know, went over the horizon. So you'd send a dog out forever looking. Okay. Yeah, definitely didn't hit it. and then here, and I've had friends tell me like, oh, it's different. I'm like, well, that's odd. I don't know how they could be different. And so you know, learn for 8 years, I'm like super quick on the shot. Like you hear that you have your gun shouldered and you're ready to go as soon as you have it lined up, sure. Right. And here, you know, soon, same thing. So I started, I would shoot and, but then the bird would go 5 more feet and land on a tree limb. And I'm like, well, clearly I missed it, but now it's just like, why is it sitting there looking at me? You know? So, yeah. Way different.
Yeah, way that's different. Definitely not the experience you have in the Midwest typically. So
no,
I'll look forward to getting out west and trying that, because yeah, I've heard the same thing from other folks as well.
Yeah, and it's because this last fall was my first time really getting out a lot. We moved in September of 19. And so we had a lot to move and I hardly got out, but it was kind of my first time really gauging early season to late season rough grouse. And so you could tell late that they were pressured.
Sure.
They were different, but still not nearly what early season Wisconsin was. So I don't know. It's different.
Well, it sounds fun. I mean, certainly I'd have to train a little harder. I think the hiking, the elevation would be a bit of a difference. So I'll probably be more out of breath, but
It is, but it's also not as thick cover here.
Sure.
There. So, I mean, and there's so many different creeks and that's where they are. So it's, you know, even finding them location wise is different from in the Midwest.
Sure. Yeah. To me, that's so cool. Like, right? It's fun. It's always the treasure hunt aspect of it, right?
Yes. And it was perfect for the dogs.
Oh, I bet.
Especially early season, you know, when it's warm and right there in the creek bed, they could cool down, but you could see a lot of good dog work.
Nice. Oh, yeah. That's so cool.
So
especially
part.
I'd imagine with not as much cover, you've got a good view of the dog working too.
Yes. Yep. For sure. But it's funny. So, when I started early season with my friend, she has a dog that I think he's seven years old now. And he would, when a grouse would fly, he would just watch them and then stare up in the tree. So he's totally Montana grouse savvy. And by the end of the season, my young Bronco male was doing the same thing, even out training the other day when the pigeons were flying away, he'd stare up in the tree and like, oh my gosh, he's turned into a Montana grouse dog.
Also sounds like me after a full day of Zoom meetings, just going outside and like
staring up in a tree. Right. Warbler neck. Oh, I love it. Oh, goodness. So another part I wanted you to talk about, Ashley, was the importance of mentoring and reaching out to new hunters and, you know, kind of an approach suggestion that you have for that.
Sure. Yeah. So what I talked about earlier is still true across the board, I think, which is not too much pressure on somebody, right? If they're interested in hunting and you're interested in mentoring, really pay attention to that person's pace and what they feel comfortable with. I think, you know, from friends of mine that grew up hunting and don't hunt now, a lot of times the number one thing they'll cite is a bad experience, right? So, you know, whether it's kids or teenagers or adults, it always kind of comes back to this, like, give people a good first few experiences to go off of, you know, so that they can really see the good times, because there are going to be a lot of frustrating times. There are going to be a lot of times when you've just crashed through trees the entire day and only found a handful of grouse, you know. And so really just thinking about that person's experience and trying to give them a well-paced, good experience. And one thing that really helped for me was just having a community of folks. So I would say, you know, in addition to mentoring somebody, Make sure that you're reaching out to other folks who might be interested in mentoring or who could connect them with resources. That's really helpful as a new hunter to have somebody say, oh, you should talk to Ben. He knows someone who has some equipment that you could probably borrow. Or you should reach out to Emmy. She's going out this weekend and she might be willing to take you along. So, you know, really just being patient, thoughtful, and providing connections to folks and opportunities to get to know your gun. Like I said, you know, going and doing trap shooting and then also seeing the dog work. So especially for the folks who are listening to your podcast, for me, it's been so wonderful to get to watch so many different dogs work and how they work and the lifestyles, you know, that different hunters have with those dogs. So giving somebody a range of different experiences with different dogs is really beneficial to making sure that when they do decide on a dog, they're making a choice that's really the best for them and the dog.
I love that. I love that. Having, you know, just taking the time, spending maybe a year or two going along mentoring just shooting and not having a dog to have that opportunity to work with so many different breeds and maybe key in on which one is ideal for you and the type of cover that there is in your area. I love that.
Right.
And I think too often when we get into something new or have interest in it, the scariest thing is, what do I all need to get to be able to do this?
And absolutely,
I think too many get overboard with that of, I'm going to need a brand new gun. I'm going to need some brush pants and some new comfortable boots. And I mean, what do you think are some of just the essentials to get out there and give it a try without diving in deep and being afraid that it's going to cost you so much to try out this new hobby?
Yeah, that's a great question because it can be expensive. But what I'll say is that I started hunting. So my husband's family has a gun shop in South Carolina. And so his sister, who's a gunsmith, picked out a Remington 870 for me and was like, start with this, you know, see how it feels, you know, decide on if you want something else later, but this is a good starter gun. And I had some hand-me-down brush pants, got an orange vest, and then it was really just other stuff that I had from other outdoor pursuits. So, I had some extra tufts from being in Alaska, from doing trail work up there. So still wear my extra tufts out in the woods. You know, those hand-me-down brush pants and, you know, when it comes to hunting, it's just like any other outdoor pursuit, right? Like hiking or anything else where you want to have those good layers of clothing and you want to have different gloves that hold in the heat well, things like that. So, I mean, for me, it was really a vest and a gun and some hearing protection, eye protection, that sort of thing. But everything else I kind of cobbled together either from what people had given me or what I already had from other outdoor pursuits.
Exactly. And even wearing a pair of jeans till you, you know, decide, well, like there's a lot of briars in this area. They're poking through my jeans, but not all areas have that. So you'd be just fine.
Yeah. And I also found that, you know, I don't know about you, Courtney, but I always have like a couple pairs of jeans that are just slightly too small for me. And so sometimes
I got plenty of those.
So sometimes I would slip those on underneath a pair of, you know, the bigger jeans. And so getting that double layer, especially in Minnesota, it gets cold. And so I just really, that second layer of jeans were like served as my base layer and put another pair of jeans over it. And so, yeah, until I got brush pants, I doubled up on jeans.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you'll be surprised how many things that you have right in your closet are ready to just be able to get out there and do it.
Yep. And I hope that folks who are newer to it know that nobody is going to point and laugh or say any, you know, it's something that we all, you know, have to keep in mind is what do we have on hand? What can we use that we've already got? Because, you know, I wish I had infinite money, but I don't. So I have to make the most of what I've got.
Yep. Exactly. Get a little pieces here and there as you can of what you need the most.
Yep.
Oh, random question. Do you keep your grouse tails?
Yes, some of them.
Yeah.
Usually if it's like a special situation. I also am friends with a lot of folks in the fly fishing community, so I'll occasionally hand off my feathers to folks who want to fly tie
Nice.
flies.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I do keep some of them.
Cool. Do you have any on display, or what do you do?
So I do have one in my living room on display, and that was the first grouse that I shot. This is going to sound strange, but I actually like just tucking one grouse feather into kind of random places, like in my car or in my living room, or just places where I almost forget, and I'll be digging through something of like, oh, that's right. And usually it's related to some great hunt. The
That's cool.
ladies that I hunt with do something called grousemas. And
Okay.
so every year on grouse up opener, we get together and we go and hunt. And so I really enjoy just remembering those moments with them.
Too fun. I like that. Grousemas.
Yeah, like Christmas for grouse.
Right. I love it. To rewind a little bit, you had mentioned about ear protection. So, are you wearing an ear protection that still allows you to hear the grouse flush?
I have tried some of the more advanced ear protection systems, and I think, I'm still looking for what really works well for me as a woman. I guess as somebody with a smaller framed face, I've found that some of those ear protections actually get in the way of me getting my cheek onto the gun. And so right now I'm just still using, the basics, but
Okay.
always making sure that I've got some in. I've heard a lot from older grouse hunters that it's really important to protect your hearing.
Yeah.
So I definitely try to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I know. I'm so torn with that because I haven't been able to find something yet where I can still hear the flush.
Yeah,
But I
sure.
know if I don't wear it, then sooner than later, I'm never going to be able to hear the flush regardless. So,
Sure.
so,
It is really tough. Sometimes I'll do hearing protection in the ear that's, in my right ear that's closer to, I know it technically it's still a loud noise, but a lot of times I'll do it in the ear that's closer to the gun.
Okay.
If I feel like I've had a couple of flushes and I'm not catching it.
Yeah.
But I know exactly what you're saying. It can be really tough. Especially if you've got really crunchy leaves or snow where you're already making a bunch of noise.
Yeah.
So I feel you on that.
Yeah. And it's nothing more than just I love the sounds. And I want to hear it because that's part of the magic for me being out
Yeah.
there is the flush of the ruff grouse.
Oh, it's so great.
It is.
And the drumming too, which I'm so excited
Yeah.
for.
Oh, I can't
It's
wait.
going to be happening so soon.
I
So
know.
I keep going out into the woods and like listening for what my ears pick up always as like a dirt bike or a motorcycle first.
Right.
So I can't wait to hear my first drumming grouse this spring.
Yeah. I know. I'm almost this is ridiculous. I'm almost more excited for this spring season and trying to get time to go out and do some traveling and even go out east to see if I can get into some leks and watch the sharp tails
Oh,
do their
nice.
dance. And like,
Yes.
that stuff is almost more exciting than actually getting out there for hunting, but I won't be able to have my dogs with, I won't take
Sure.
them. But that's the beauty of all this too. It's beyond the hunt. It's the cool birds.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, just like we were talking about earlier, I mean, you can be out there listening for grouse at the same time as you're looking for warblers. So I just love when the woods in Minnesota get repopulated with their wildlife, or, the grouse have always been there, but they're more obvious in the spring.
Yeah. All right, before I let you go, what is your favorite game bird recipe?
So this is a really tough one. I have so many favorites, you know, and some depend on how much time you have and others depend on how fancy you want to get.
Right.
And I think my favorite is one that Julia and I made last year. We made kind of this like white sauce woodcock pizza, and it had figs and cheese and mushrooms, and it was kind of on this thin crust that was then cooked on an outdoor grill, and it was just heaven. So
that sounds good.
Outdoor grilled pizza with wild game on it, highly recommended. Delicious.
Yeah, for sure.
Julia Schrenkler has has all sorts of recommendations. So go find her on Twitter, Instagram. She's she always posts the great food that she makes.
Okay. Yeah, I will search that because it'd be nice to link that recipe in as well to our show notes here.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Was there anything else that you wanted to add, Ashley, that we didn't touch on?
Just that folks can find me on Instagram and Twitter as Grouse Lady. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, just to have folks go to roughgrousesociety.org and join the organization or reach out to me and ask any questions that folks might have.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you, Courtney.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. Please help me out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from and hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.